As you heard, I'm Jonathan Eisler from the Center for Innovation in Business Law and Technology. Always happy to be here at the Nassau Bar. I want to introduce my student, Alex, who you can meet. Alex is our this semester's Entrepreneurship Assistance Fellow. We pick a student every semester. And he's working with me on some sort of general legal education for businesses and lawyers on internet law issues, and we are seeking now to connect with a startup so that we can provide it not legal advice, but legal information that will help it grow its business. This semester, I should say, in the good public broadcasting, this semester the fellowship is sponsored by Carter DeLuca, so I thank them publicly. And definitely meet Alex, who is an excellent, excellent student and a future lawyer. And if your practices are interested in sponsoring the fellowship, we'll talk later. But that's not why I'm here today. I want to talk about an issue that carries over not only to our clients' business, but ours as well. And that has to do with the intentional and unintentional disclosures that can occur through the use of social media. Talking about unintentional disclosures, I actually earlier today posted these slides, and a professional friend pointed out that I had put international on the front page, so I have to fix that, but that was an unintentional disclosure of the fact that I didn't look when spellcheck didn't get it, and I should not ever. I bother my students all the time, so mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, it's public. But we're talking about social media. But first, let's first talk about confidentiality. As attorneys, we are intimately, I think sometimes, too familiar and comfortable with the idea of confidentiality. We've got Rule 1.6. Currently, that's where our obligation in New York arises. Some really interesting limits on that obligation. But in any event, and we have certainly a culture of confidentiality that supports everything from the attorney-client privilege to the trust that a prospective client will have in us. But it's key to all businesses and all organizations. We see issues of confidentiality arising in due diligence. That a company opening its books, opening its business to a suitor, to a potential partner, to a potential employee, senior employee, whatever it is, or even a regulator, needs to be confident that the information it is sharing will be used only by those in entities and only for the appropriate purpose in order to feel comfortable doing so. Joint ventures. Frequently, you've got issues of mutual disclosure where even if it's not a formal combination of the two organizations, still, you've got to know what the other brings to the table, what the other can do, what the other is planning to do, future plans, in order to make this joint venture worth doing. Confidentiality comes up in issues of employment. In terms of the obligations put on employees regarding the organization's information. In terms sometimes of things that a prospective employee is sharing but should not be shared further. Issues of credit reports and how they may or may not be used in evaluating potential employees and what happens to that information afterwards. Confidentiality is crucial in the technology context. As I'll talk about in a little bit, technology companies need people to test their systems. I think this month are seeing the challenges of insufficient testing for major technology systems. Sometimes you can't load test that far, but devices are farmed out, whether it's to employees or cell phone carriers. Sometimes journalists with strict non-disclosure agreements, sometimes those devices haven't even been announced yet as potential, but they're prototypes, they're being tested. Confidentiality, hugely important in there. The the competitive forces are so strong in technology issues, in technology companies, that they have to keep their next development secret. It's why, although there's a lot of portability of employees at the junior level in high-tech regions, at the senior level, not nearly as much, and there are very strong limits placed on where they may work, at least in the short term, what they may say, and when it's suspected they've brought more than they should, lawsuits invariably are brought. Confidentiality is key in media. Reporters depend on sources. Whether it's an unnamed senior official or an entirely unmentioned leak. And the sources, either for their professional survival or their actual survival, frequently need their identities kept confidential, their roles kept confidential. And we support that, to a certain extent, in the law, in order to promote better knowledge, better information, better government, whatever, you know, on private side, better governance of companies, and so on. And we are not alone in having a formal obligation. Medical professionals, for similar reasons, have similar obligations. And certain regulated industries have limits on what their employees may say. A company that is filing for a public offering has a quiet period. The rules about insider trading are essentially confidentiality obligations. Government workers, intelligence or otherwise, you have top secret classification. That doesn't mean someone stamped it on your folder, on your head, but that you know you are legally bound to keep information confidential. This week at Touro, we had a visit from an attorney, Mark Zaid, who practices in Washington in areas of whistleblowing and national security. And he was talking about the law that says if one is in possession of classified, I hate that word, just because that doesn't tell you anything. How is it classified? I should say top secret classified information without authorization, merely having that is a violation of law. It's illegal to have it, even if you didn't want it. So there are all these different professions and professional roles where confidentiality is mandatory. And of course, we have the law. We have, as I've said, some specific laws. We have laws that support confidentiality. Journalist shield laws. The jurisprudence of the First Amendment that has established over the years anonymity, the preservation of anonymity can itself be justified by the First Amendment, that in order for certain people to have the freedom to speak, they need the protection of speaking anonymously. Okay, why did you just do that? And we shouldn't forget trade secret protection. We have state and federal trade secret protection law, very relevant in the IP context. And among the factors that determines whether that protection will be enforced, whether someone who has an alleged trade secret will be punished, is did the organization that claims the trade secret take the steps necessary to try to keep something confidential? Did it at least put up the barricades, put in place the non-disclosure agreements, and so on? Even if it ultimately got out, did the organization take reasonable steps to try to keep it from getting out? And that can be the factor on which a trade secret case stands or falls. As attorneys, we rely upon the written word. We respect and advocate for the binding nature of contracts, as well as of statutes. But what we all understand, and what sometimes we have to remind our clients about, is that an agreement is just that. That prohibiting disclosure is not, legally or practically, the same thing as preventing disclosure. All an agreement can do, as important as it is to have that agreement, whether as a standalone or as part of a broader contract, all an agreement can do is set the conditions, establish what information is or is not to be treated as confidential, by whom, and potentially what are the consequences if that treatment is not respected, if the information is shared or leaked or not protected properly. And it may be specific consequences in the agreement, liquidated damages, any sort of, or it may simply be state contractual breach of contract type remedy. But in any event, it's a contract, or it's a policy, or it's a statute. But they cannot, none of those things can keep information from being leaked. What's the classic saying? A secret between two people is not a secret? Something like that. It's close to that if it's not exactly that. But it points out that the only way to keep information from being spread is not to share it in the first place. That's not practical. In many contexts, it isn't. So, as with everything else in our practices and our clients' businesses, this is a question of risk assessment, risk management. What are the downsides of sharing with these protections in place? What can happen if the protections don't work? Versus the downsides of not sharing. We share a little. We deal with this in reverse. Whenever we solicit or are solicited by a prospective client. I realize if any of you is in-house, you may recall this from the time when the client wasn't the organization signing the paycheck. But in any event, right? We know, because our obligations under 1.6, etc., start the moment we begin the conversation, whether or not we are ultimately retained. And because we also have to be very cognizant of potential conflicts of interest. Our initial conversations with prospective clients must be brief, must be very limited. And I know in my own practice, and I'm sure in your practices, you've had that moment. Maybe you've hopefully set it up before you've gotten that far, saying, look, I think we might be able to help you, but understand, for your benefit, for the benefit of my practice, I don't want to know too much yet. I need to find out whether we have an existing conflict of interest before you share anything that, well, you wouldn't want the other side to have access to. What you're really saying is, I don't want to give up that previous business to potentially take your case on necessarily. But ultimately, you get the bare minimum. You run it by whatever your practice's conflicts check process is. And only then, assuming you get a clean, no known conflicts, right? It's like no known disclosure. Only then can you say, we're good. Here's our, here's how we work. Now tell me more. Because we know that if there is disclosure, we've got a potential problem. Not all information is the same. Not all information, even confidential information, need be or should be treated the same. Some things are more confidential than others, with apologies to George Orwell. And when you're dealing with confidential information, you've got to, again, assess these risks and manage the risks. Consider how much or how little you disclose. Often when entrepreneurs are speaking with venture capitalists or angel financiers, VC funds, angels, rarely are willing to sign non-disclosures because they get so many business pitches, because they don't want to be in a situation where 5 years down the road, they fund company B and someone who alleges, oh, I told you about that 5 years ago, and you've got to prove the negative. No, I didn't remember it and share it 5 years later. So they don't want to be legally bound. But at the same time, and so you've got to trust them. That's their line. But at the same time, it's what, I mean, we don't often sign non-disclosures as lawyers, but we are legally bound. We can just point to, you know, we're risking our professional lives if we violate this. So you don't need a contract with us. But at the same time, the entrepreneur may not share everything initially in the first pitch, in the elevator pitch. Selective disclosure as a way of managing these risks. In some circumstances, you can give everything but change it. You look at issues of health privacy, for example. There are formal requirements because health information has benefit to research. And aggregated health information has benefits to research, but it's also sensitive. And so, under the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act privacy rules, if a covered entity wants to release information for research purposes, it's required to anonymize it, to at least make an effort to remove the identification of the actual patients, leave the scientifically relevant stuff there, but not the personal information. It doesn't always work. But that's the concept. It's the concept of any kind of redaction, which, again, doesn't always work. But that's the point. So let's reveal, not necessarily selectively disclose, fully disclose without the irrelevant, sensitive parts. Sometimes you have access restrictions, technological access restrictions, or physical ones. In certain intelligence communities, certain documents and media storage devices are not allowed to leave the room. Literally, are not allowed to be taken from the room. Again, if you look to the HIPAA rules, there are requirements on the privacy and the security side to limit electronic access. Who is permitted to log into these accounts to read these files? How do we separate that? Agreements are a key part of the risk management strategy. But we're mobile now. We are mobile and we're wireless. I look at my phone right now, not to answer it, but to point out that I have 4G service. Probably being irradiated from that really big tower. What does that mean? It means that wirelessly, I have a better data connection on this device standing here in this room than I had in my home 4 years ago, wired. Certainly 10 years ago, probably 100 times as fast. We are always on, potentially, always connected. Mobile devices, too, and I'm not going to remove it because it will ruin the recording I'm making, but in this tablet of mine, I have something that is this big. Micro secure digital card, micro SD card. I don't like to take it out because it's easy enough to drop. It is literally the size of my pinky nail. It holds 64 gigabytes of storage. There is some multiple of the Library of Congress that is represented, at least the books that is represented by 64 gigabytes. It is a huge, huge amount of data that I'm just carrying around and pops out, which has benefits. If you don't want to always carry it around, but think about, remember brief bags? Anyone remember brief bags? I got to work at home. Right? I'm bringing home the client files. Now, I'm bringing home the entire firm's files. That assumes you can't just get online and do it remotely. But what that means is that physical and electronic access restrictions are almost entirely irrelevant, or can be. Selective disclosure, redaction, because the data are leaving. And they're vulnerable to malicious hacking as well as accidental disclosures. So we have the ideal of confidentiality. We have the mandate of confidentiality. And then we have social media, which are the antithesis of confidentiality. Social media as a concept, not a new concept. The example I like to give in perhaps not as formal, well, this is okay, we're all friends here. The public bathroom store wall, stall wall is a social medium. It is. It is a place where people have the ability to share their thoughts with others in an equal access, well, you know, maybe gender restricted, hopefully, right? But an equal access. In my law school, we had, you know, you talk about a Facebook wall, we had a wall, an actual wall. And the wall was dedicated to students' opinions. You weren't really supposed to use spray paint. Paper and tape were the media of choice. And there were conventions. You had to sign everything. But it was a place, it was a public forum for ideas and responses and criticisms and support, very much the way we have online social media. The difference, of course, is that today's online social media are without geographic restriction, often with limited abilities to identify people. Anonymity is never absolute online. Do not assume it is. But you also have cultures of sharing. Different media have different cultures of sharing, but ultimately, a social medium is not for introspection. They're designed to allow sharing, dissemination. And they are phenomenally accessible by design. Don't think of a social medium as a website, because that is just one channel. Whether you're talking about LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or go down the list, all of these services are accessible not only through web browsers on computers, but through cell phones and smartphones and tablets and text messages on dumb phones, excuse me, feature phones. You don't need it. There is a certain amount of brevity required. I actually think that's a good thing for organized written expression. But that same brevity, there are technological fixes. So that, yes, on Twitter, for example, you have 140 characters. But if you can include a shortened link that leads you to an entire other website, or to a picture, or to a video, or to the rest of the 3.5 pages you'd like to write. So there are methods that have been developed for expanding beyond the limits of characters. Facebook allows more, LinkedIn allows more. Still, they have official limits, but functionally, they don't limit. And since everything is done connected, once you click on a link, you're immediately at this. You don't have to wait and look it up later. But we need to remember that it's not just the text or even the links that are being shared in social media. And this is where I start getting into the intentional or unintentional side of my talk. Location information. Whether it's derived from the GPS chip that is literally legally mandated for every single cellular phone in this country, from the featurist, dumbest phone to the latest phone, every single one by law has a GPS chip in it. It's called the E911 service. It is there so that emergency service personnel getting a call from someone who is unaware of or unable to share his or her location, that the EMS, the emergency personnel, can still send help. Whether it's on a boat, that's why it's GPS, or whether it's in a dark corner, or someone starts saying, you know, I've just had an accident, and they're not able to respond, that's why those chips are there and they cannot be turned off. And there's some control over how that information is otherwise shared with your device, but they're all there. But it doesn't require that. Even if your device doesn't have a GPS chip, if it's connected to the internet, it has what's called an IP address, a numerical address, like a telephone number. It's not a permanent one in most cases. But every device connected directly to the internet has a unique numeric identifier. Or its network does. And there are databases, constantly updated databases, that have a record of geographically where each access point is located. How do they develop those? Because those of us who are walking around with Google or Apple or perhaps even Microsoft smartphones with GPS chips and internet services may have, without realizing it, turned on the feature that allows those companies to constantly update those databases. You walk past a Starbucks location, which will soon be a Google wireless location anyway, but you walk past a Panera Bread or a library, any place with a Wi-Fi identifier, and your device, see, you may not connect to it, but your device detects it. And if your GPS is on, it will match those data and send them off in the background to Google or to Apple or to Microsoft or whomever. So even if your device doesn't have a GPS chip, with well above 90% degree of accuracy, providers can tell roughly where in the world you are. And so that's being shared, whether or not we realize it. Other things being shared. You all have cameras, I would imagine, of some sort. And the vast majority of you are probably using digital cameras because you can't buy film anymore. And you can't get it developed if you buy it. What you need to know, if you didn't already, is that every digital camera includes within every picture a certain amount of meta information, a certain amount of information about the camera and about the picture and about the exposure settings. Okay, fine. But if your device has, it will also include, if it has a clock and a calendar in your camera, whether or not it's printed on the picture file includes the date and the time it was taken. And if your device has a GPS chip in it, and it's not just cell phone cameras, increasingly cameras, from point-and-shoots to digital SLRs, or lensless, I know there's a whole new fit, but they have these chips too. Why? Because people like to be able to remember where it was that they took a particular picture without having to note it. They're phenomenal resources if you're traveling and you're shooting pictures all over the country or all over the world. You can literally come home, plug your pictures in, get a freely available software program for any computer, point it to your collection of pictures, and it will map them for you. Because that information is embedded in the file. But what if you post a picture online? Guess what? That same information, it's called EXIF, E-X-I-F, and it stands for something, and I don't have it to hand. That information is embedded in most of those photos as well. So not only can the person who took the photo learn about it, so too can anyone who's able to download that photo. And that in itself, as I will show, that in itself can reveal confidential information. How can it reveal it? That's the implicit side. We also, from a cultural perspective, those of us who use social media on a regular basis, sometimes forget the public-private line. Or we just don't care. Or we just mess up. C, e.g., Anthony Weiner, right? Or a whole lot of other people who thought what they said was private wasn't. Because they don't understand it, or they click the wrong button, or whatever it was. So this context makes it very easy to be heard. What I want to share with you are some examples that others, as well as I, have pulled from the world. This point was first really highlighted to me. This goes back a number of years to a blog post by a very, very smart guy named Peter Shankman. If you don't know helpareporter.com, you need to. This is just a personal tip. It is the best way for you to get connected with media people who want to hear what you have to say and share it with the world for free. Helpareporter.com, write it down. But anyway, Peter is a PR master. But he also likes highlighting when people do dumb things, or what could have been a dumb thing. And so a few years ago, Peter pointed out that another digital media specialist was on his way to Memphis, Tennessee, to address FedEx. Now, if you know anything about FedEx in Memphis, what you know is that FedEx takes a lot of pride in Memphis. I used to work for a company that shared facilities, so we took an old FedEx building, so we got to see a lot of it. But FedEx loves Memphis, like Coke in Atlanta. And so this digital media specialist flew down to Memphis, got off the plane, and tweeted, "True confession, but I'm in one of those towns where I scratch my head and say I would die if I have to live here." Now, when I first started giving these presentations, one of the earliest ones I gave, someone came up to me and said, "I know this person." And what happened was he got off the plane and was immediately exposed to some really racially insensitive, repulsive stuff that was being said around him. And that's what triggered this personal reaction. But he tweeted it publicly. And so people to whom he was about to give a talk were watching him because they were interested in him, and they saw this tweet. And so someone at FedEx, someone in his future audience, wrote a letter to him and his bosses and the FedEx bosses criticizing him for this. And among, so you can see, and this is all was all in this piece from Peter Shankman. I like the last sentence that I've excerpted. "A hazard of social networking is people will read what you write." It's very true. This wasn't confidential, but it shows how easy it is to reveal information. Another great Twitter story. Someone went to interview for a job at Cisco, the networking company, and then tweeted, "Cisco just offered me a job. Now I have to weigh the utility of a fatty paycheck against the daily commute to San Jose and hating the work." Cisco is a very searchable term. They watch what people say about them. Someone tweeted back, "Who is the hiring manager? I'm sure they would love to know that you will hate the work. We here at Cisco are versed in the web." People are watching. I collect lawyers and law student tweets just by virtue of having a search term. The vast majority of people I've never met don't know who they are, but they post to public. Twitter is particularly valuable for me, for bad examples. Talking about the kinds of things you don't realize are being public. Doug McMillan wrote a couple of pieces in 2009 in Business Week that I highly recommend. This is one of them. Look it up, a Twitter code of conduct. He leads with the story that an ad agency called Tokini was pitching certain business. The prospective client came in and said, "Oh, you're also talking to our competitor." "We are." "How did you know?" "Because someone at Tokini had tweeted, 'Oh, we met with that other company today.'" It wasn't intended to reveal, but it's just so easy and casual to do that. And then going back to this issue of technology and non-disclosure agreements, about the same time, this is actually from March of, a little later, 2010, you may recall that there was a device coming out called the iPad. It's kind of a big deal. And Apple wanted to make sure that as of launch date, it got informed press coverage. Not just it's, you know, and another thing, you know, one thing more kind of thing, but But reporters could, the moment Apple announced it, write a review. So Apple ceded, as many tech companies do, ceded iPads to various publications, including the Wall Street Journal. And those iPads were ceded with extremely strong restrictions. Not only contractual restrictions, but physical. They literally had to be chained to a desk. So that they couldn't be left in, a German pub in Silicon Valley, as happened to Apple with one of its iPhones. But there was a 10-page agreement, wrote Doug McMillan in Business Week, that allowed people who wanted to see, or that restricted disclosure on the iPad, except during an in-person meetings with Apple representatives in February, Wall Street Journal deputy managing editor Alan Murray posted a short message to Twitter that announced he was using the device. The tweet was later removed from the site. Obviously not soon enough. Because not only does Doug McMillan know about it, you know the Library of Congress is archiving everything that goes across Twitter? They don't yet have the mechanism for people to go in and search it because there's just too much. They're still working on the mechanics of it. but everything. Everything. And when things are deleted, quote unquote, from Twitter, that doesn't delete them from, oh, I don't know, my collection of screenshots or stories like Doug McMillan had. Politicians. Britain's Secretary of State for Energy tweeted, this is from October of 2011, from someone else, fine, it said, but I do not want fingerprints, my fingerprints, on the story. Let's see. He thought it was a private message. Again, the Anthony Weiner syndrome. It's very easy to missend, especially if you're following Twitter on your cell phone, to missend. It looks like a text. You respond to it like a text. But if you don't remember to put D space and the name of the Twitter user before you respond, it goes out to everybody. Sunlight, I think it's the Sunlight Foundation, Paulette Whoops. They have a website, Paulette Whoops. All it's there for is to archive politicians' tweets that are later deleted. They watch them all, and if they then go away, they post them. So it's very easy. National security, potentially. Governmental matters. Very easy to missend, to reveal. Oh. I told you I'd talk about a picture. What you see there is two things. What you see there is a photo of an old stereo, says vintage from the 90s, works, that was posted on October 17, 2010. So you see there a photo, and you see the breach of a non-disclosure agreement for an unreleased device. And I don't mean that. This was posted by a tech blogger named Josh Topolsky. And he posted this picture. It's kind of cute, you know? It says, vintage from the 90s. I'm old. Well, apparently. The other thing that Topolsky did was he used, to take that picture, an unreleased cell phone. An unannounced cell phone. I know you can't read that from here, and you really have to be into the industry to know. But what it says here is this was taken by a Palm Pre cell phone with a 5-megapixel camera. And as of October 17, 2010, such a thing did not exist. It had not been pre-announced. It was coming. He didn't say he had it. It wasn't even like the managing editor from the Wall Street Journal who said. All Topolsky did was take a picture of an old stereo and post it. But within minutes, people had looked at the EXIF data. I saved the photo for my collection, so I can actually call this up today. And he revealed, without saying a word, that he had a non-released, a non-announced device that he was testing. That's how easy it is for all of us to reveal confidences using social media. So, sports fans, I'm not, but sports fans may recall, back in 2010, ESPN writer Bill Simmons wrote on Twitter earlier Tuesday night about the possibility of the NFL superstar rejoining his former team. Rumors swirling about a Pats mini trade for Randy Moss, he tweeted. He soon deleted the tweet and said it was supposed to be a private message. Oops. So, not a whole lot of consequence, but and maybe it was intended to be a cute little leak of what should have been a pre-embargo story. But it certainly got a lot of notice. I caught this one day. Some of you may know who Brad Meltzer is. He's an author, and he also created a television show for the History Channel called Decoded. Well, this was, I don't have the date in front of me, this was before Decoded launched. And I saw Meltzer's response. I was following him. I said, what is he talking about? Turns out, Nearham and Williams, which I don't know if that was his agent or PR firm, trailer to Brad Meltzer's upcoming History Channel series Decoded. Here it is. They tweeted that. His response was, please don't share this. History is going to kill us. Look at the email. It says don't share. But it was accessible even if it hadn't been promoted. That's how easy this is. And And let's talk about lawyers. We are often, I think we actually are a little too casual about confidences. Not that we don't respect confidences. But when everything is secret, you don't treat anything as top secret. If an ordinary employee is told, oh, don't talk about this, this is top secret, hide this file away, you get some awareness. But for us, everything we do must be kept confidential. So sometimes we don't always think about it. It's just inherent. So what about where we are? When can where we are reveal a confidence? I always used to give this example. A hypothetical example. Imagine you're in-house counsel for a New York-based clothing manufacturer. And suddenly on Twitter or on Facebook or on Foursquare, which is about place, you reveal that you're in Bentonville, Arkansas for a week. What's in Bentonville, Arkansas?
Walmart.
What else? Nothing. Bentonville, Arkansas. What is going to bring, in the middle of a work week, a New York-based lawyer for a clothing manufacturer to Bentonville, Arkansas? A negotiation with Walmart of some kind. Either that or he's interviewing. Whatever it is. But not something that's likely to be meant to be public. So that was my hypothetical. And then I see this. Wow, it's apparently rush minute for Bentonville traffic. I was like, great, it actually happened. Look at that. As it occurs, Anthony Martin is the chief privacy officer for Walmart. So he was at work. It's a great illustration. It didn't actually prove the point, but he agreed with me when I got back to him on this. He said, yeah, I'm not revealing anything other than I'm going to work in my own office, but, you know. So I wanted to see, how else? Capital punishment for the win. So it turns out, you can search on Twitter for where tweets were posted. Not every tweet says so, but if it's either turned on or whatever it is. So I went to see, are there tweets from Bentonville, Arkansas? And sure enough, October 21st, so a week ago, someone named Jay Thornton posted this picture. Not quite sure what they were doing in these superhero costumes. It says, capital punishment for the win, whatever that means, with Matt, Rianne, and five others at Memorial Park. Pick. And this is where they were, Memorial Park. The exact geographic coordinates where the camera was standing when it took that picture, because it was embedded in this Twitter message. And all you need to do is click on from Bentonville, Arkansas. And not only do you know he's in Bentonville, you know he's there. Look, there's Memorial Park, exactly right. Talk about a stalking opportunity, but also think about how that. And it's not just Bentonville, Arkansas. It could be within the same city. You post something that wasn't work-related, but it shows you're in Google's headquarters. You're probably negotiating with Google. Where we are can be a confidence, and it's easy enough to reveal it. This, there's a Twitter account that watches for people who mention bank cards and debit cards and credit cards with pictures and repost them, and that's where I found this. So Nicole Guerra Gamboa, her Royal Bank debit card number is, and there it is. Will you stop doing that? It's not that secret. I think it is. Did I bump this? Hello? Hello? I think I just crashed the TV set. Oh, there we go. Nice TV set. So, look at this. So, our clients are doing this about business information and personal information. We are doing it. I don't want to use social media. You could say that, but you need to use social media if for no other reason than to find out what other people are doing on social media. I did a thing here at the Inn of Court a number of years ago about the ethical issues of using social media in litigation. And the State Bar is now working on an entire set of guidelines for just that, both the jury side and litigation side. But There are also real professional benefits, not so much in advertising, but in relationship building, in hearing about cases and developments and business developments. You hear about it first on Twitter if you're following the right people. I've gotten speaking engagements with a tweet. I've created conferences out of a single tweet. And I'm not some super Twitter guy. That's the power of this medium. It is social. You can establish relationships, but you also have to be aware of it. Let's talk a couple of lawyers. So I have a lawyer in a law firm search, right? Just finished my jury trial, $215,000 judgment. That's public. Insurance company offered $52,000 to settle. Not so public. Thanks to my client for having courage to try this case. Now, even setting aside issues of lawyer advertising and past performance and disclaimers, look at this. You think the insurance company is going to offer this guy anything the next time he tries a case with them? He just blew past their offer. Hey world, I don't know who this lawyer is. Anybody know Bob Pickering? I don't. I just have a Twitter search for lawyers. Talking about lawyers, trials and juries and clients, and this came up. And I have an entire collection of law students, thank God not my law students, not our law students, other schools, I've checked, doing unbelievably stupid things, career-destroying things on Twitter, self-identifying as law students. So what do we do about it? Risk management. Policies. Policies are like contracts. If an organization's policy says or assumes, we block social media, no, it doesn't. It doesn't. Unless they also block cell phones. They may block certain social media access through their internal network, but that doesn't do anything. Ask the Los Angeles school system. Hear about this? They just did an entire release of iPads to students. New program. Lock down iPads. Can't access anything. Yeah. There's a Dilbert cartoon I love that Dilbert talks about. He wants to create a filtering software for kids. And Dogbert says, do you know if you put a little hat on a snowball, it stands a better chance in hell? Right? Within hours, the high school kids had gotten around these filters. So technical means are not enough. It's important because it sets, but you have to understand. Policies are about setting expectations and consequences. Training. How to use these resources as well as how not to. The right tools, which software gives more control, best practices. What does your industry require? Certain industries have regulatory issues specifically for social media. Monitoring, someone from the organization looking for the name of the organization, looking for people from the organization, people who are not only identified with but identifiable with the organization. And also making sure you find out what people are saying about you. And insurance. There are insurance policies here, as with other areas of internet use and business, but you have to ask the carriers and the brokers. You have to evaluate the risk. But it has to be part of the risk management strategy for us as practitioners with businesses, as well as for our clients. So with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have. And if not... Yes, sir.
Have you a clue as to how to keep confidential information to a client, who's a corporate client, when you're speaking to one person who is in charge of the operation, and you say, look, this is privilege between us. Don't go spreading it around. As long as it's you and I, it's privilege. But if you decide to bring your manager in on your own and tell him what we're talking about, you're killing the privilege. We're very likely going to kill the privilege.
You can't. You can't. Unless the next sentence is, oh, and by the way, here's the locked room we're putting him into. Right? We'll feed you a couple times a day. You cannot prevent. You can prohibit. You can advise. You can write a memo to the file that you advised. Of course, when you're specifically talking about privilege, you're trying to protect it, but it's ultimately the client's decision one way or the other, right? The client could waive the privilege even if it had been preserved. But it's worse than that. It is worse than that. Because as of about, I guess it's now 3-4 years ago, there's a case in New York Supreme Court, trial court, Scott versus Beth Israel. which I highly recommend you look up. It was an employment case. Dr. Scott, former employee of Beth Israel Medical Center, got into litigation afterwards. And the hospital discovered it had correspondence, emails from Scott to his lawyer from before the termination, on the hospital's own email system. And you think, well, so what? Employee-client communication, right? When is that privilege? What has to happen for that privilege to be preserved? There has to be a reasonable, subjective expectation of privacy, right? Doctrine, black letter, at least evidence law, right? Turns out the hospital had a policy that it had provided to Dr. Scott, he had read and I think signed. We, the hospital, reserve the right to monitor what goes on our hospital email system. Okay, no problem. That reservation of the right was sufficient to defeat the client's attorney-client communication privilege. So the lawyer did nothing wrong, and nor did Dr. Scott do what you're suggesting a careless client rep might do and share it. No. The choice of the client to use a particular email account and not a different one to communicate with the lawyer was sufficient to defeat the privilege. So we cannot prevent this stuff from occurring. All we can do is watch what we do, provide systems that should hopefully, you know, support client confidence, and advise, as you say, educate and advise the client, and hopefully be dealing with a client who is risk-sensitive enough to take the appropriate steps. Yeah?
But, I mean, looking back, shouldn't the attorney have said, listen, don't use your work email address. If you have issues with your employer, use your personal email address. And wasn't there, I don't know if it was Intel or some other company maybe 10 years ago, there was an issue of whether the employer actually owns the data from those emails, which were would otherwise be considered private because it owns the servers in which that information is communicated.
I think the Intel case you may be thinking of, if it's the one I suspect, is the Intel versus Hamidi case, and it was about spam, anti-spam laws, and whether it may be a different case.
Okay.
But to your hypothetical, you're right that, well, first of all, prior to this trial court decision, all of us continued based on the 1999 ABA ethics opinion that says email, we don't have to encrypt our email in order for the privilege to be preserved. It had never come up. So there was no reason for the attorney, but beyond that, let's assume today, if the first email from your client from work is, dear lawyer, I killed someone at work today. Will you represent me? Then what? Right? To suggest you go back to your client and say, please don't use your work email, it isn't necessarily privileged, that cat is already out of that particular bag. And you may not know in looking at the email address. Let's say your client works for Cablevision, has an opt-online address, or an optimum address. Are you going to know, or is everyone in your practice going to know, that this turned out to be from the work account or an employer-provided service rather than a personal one? This ruling, and there was another one since then in California, is a real challenge for us. It's a different discussion about, because encryption is not a practical answer for anyone. Email encryption is just too hard to do.
Even if you encrypt it, if it's owned by the company's, if it's residing on the company's servers and theoretically owned by that company, wouldn't they have a right to unencrypt it?
That becomes a different legal argument. But they didn't, Beth Israel didn't have to.
It was already there.
It was there, it was in clear text, it was searchable. Once things are encrypted, I mean, there's some really interesting jurisprudence on whether one can force someone to reveal a decryption key if the material that is encrypted is incriminatory. Whether there is a Fifth Amendment right not to decrypt. Most courts will say no. It's not testimony. It's like offering a key to a locked box. But encryption will at least, remember, because privilege, this is the other issue, right? Privilege is not confidentiality. Privilege is not fact. It is a legal construct. Privilege is what, even if everybody in the courtroom knows something, the jury may still be advised to disregard it. It's inadmissible. That's what privilege is all about. So even if the hospital knows there's a letter there, if the doctor, by virtue of encrypting it, had a reasonable subjective expectation of privacy, that would be enough probably to preserve the protection of the privilege. Yes, the hospital might have those data on its server, but even if it could read them, it's not allowed to use them. The problem with the Scott case was that the protection of the communication between attorney and client, which had not been missent, had not been misfiled, had not been put on a postcard, was nevertheless, the reasonable expectation of privacy was found to be insufficient. So that's why encryption could, in theory, help. In practice, and again, another talk, email encryption is an almost impossible thing to standardize on. It's just hard to do, and so we don't do it. It would be nice if we could, but we don't, so we just have to deal with the world as is. Yeah?
Just add another layer, though, to what you're discussing there. You should, if you're talking with you, if you have concerns with your clients, make sure that they are going to email you from home. Because what employers are doing now, especially myself when I'm drafting email policies and the like, I will add in language not only to inform employees that anything they send through their own email address is the property, but going to their personal, because there are some cases where, like the Scott case, where there's no question if you're using your employer's email address, you're not going to have any privacy in it. But cutting through the privacy of any data that is flowing through,
right,
or on
there's a case in New Jersey that went the other way.
Because you could, if you're using the company's computer, then you have a greater standing. But what if it's the person's personal cell phone? Accessing the Wi-Fi.
Weren't you here at the beginning of the month when I did my BYOD policy thing for the other committee? Slides are available if you want to hear them. Actually, this policy issue, because you're right, how far can a company effectively do it? You know where this really starts becoming a big problem? Is in e-discovery. Because regardless of the interplay, intra-company issues, employee-employer, because these cases, like the Scott case and like the Lovinghart versus Stengard case in New Jersey, which sort of went the other way because Stengard was using a Yahoo Mail account from work. But unlike those cases, which are employer-employee, any of you, I'm sure, who's doing any kind of discovery request is hopefully including not only the work that was done, the content from the company's computers, but also any stuff that is on home computers done by employees relating to the case. And people are demanding and are getting home computer disclosure on the e-discovery, smartphones, tablets, anything on which an employee is doing work may be appropriate fodder for electronic discovery. So even if your organization or your client's organization doesn't want to say to people, we claim ownership of the stuff on your home computer, it needs to remind and advise people that if you use your home computer or any personal device for work stuff, be aware. There's a possibility that we might be asked to get it from you, and we have to do it by law. So just keep that in mind when you use your teenager's computer to log in to work, because it doesn't always work well. Yep.
Could you talk about cloud storage and the extent to which confidentiality issues come up with cloud storage?
Sure. The short answer to that is any time information is out of your control, you are dependent on the promises of others and of the good work of others. Look, it happened before cloud storage. Law firms with small file rooms might use an outside file storage warehouse for the stuff they didn't need, right? It's not in our file room, it's in the warehouse, we need a day to go get it. But if that file storage warehouse had a break-in or a fire, or, you know, let your opposing counsel wander through, you had no control over that. That's offline stuff. Cloud storage is essentially the same thing. So that if we are using a third party, either for the software side or for the storage of our files, in most circumstances, all we have, most, is their promise that A, it's kept confidential, B, it is perhaps encrypted, and C, they take appropriate steps to keep malicious hackers out. It doesn't always work. Even Dropbox, which is pretty much the industry standard, a few years ago, because of a software glitch, for a certain period of a couple of hours, any account was accessible without a password. It wasn't clear that there was a breach, but there could have been. But it's not always about cloud storage either. It's portable storage too. I think it's the San Mateo County Legal Defense Organization, Legal Services, just had to give a breach notice, data breach notice in California, because a couple of its laptops had been stolen from the office. Not only was legal information included, health information was included because they do health advocacy. So suddenly they were revealing health information. It's the same answer, by the way. How do you deal with it? Happily, unlike email encryption, file encryption is easy. It can be automatic. And so if you're using cloud storage, or for that matter, if you're including things on laptops, or in servers that can be stolen or on devices, it is a fairly simple matter from a technical perspective to scramble that stuff so that even if someone steals the hard drive or gets the tablet or maliciously hacks into this cloud server, they can have the data. They can't do anything with it. So if your practice, and for that matter if your clients, are using third-party cloud storage, see if they can implement on their own end encrypting the files before they get stored so that it doesn't matter if they're accessed. Encryption is a good idea, and more it is being required. Massachusetts requires it when you're storing personal information, not just transmitting, but storing personal information of Massachusetts residents. And if your client has exposure in Massachusetts, it should be doing that anyway. The data breaches that you see, unless, of course, it's someone, you know, faking someone out and getting the information directly, any of these malicious hacks or stolen laptops, the breaches happen because the information is unencrypted. You never hear about my encrypted laptop was stolen, because it doesn't matter. We are running a bit low on time. I am always reachable at Turo, or you can simply find me on Twitter. It's Prof. Jonathan. I thank the committee. I'm happy to come back and have a good day.
Thank you.